Yeah. Good afternoon. Welcome to the tax committee. James, did you get the tape going there? Okay. Thank you so much. Members, just a couple of items. Representative Swales, House Bill 1105, has removed her bill today, so we're not going to hear that one. I know, sad. let's see. That one's out. Can I do this without a quorum? No. Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, so I'm also going to recall up from division back to taxes, House Bill 923, so that we'll be able to hear Representative Carlson's bill today. So that was down in the division. And with that, we're going to go to Representative Tamar, House Bill 1998. And we don't have a quorum yet, Representative Tamar, so when we do, we'll move it. And, of course, we're just going to hear them and lay them over, but we technically can't move it right now. Oh, you might get to later. Representative Tamar.
Madam Chair, so no one's moving on. What about my amendment? Should I wait
for
amendment?
Yeah, we can't move it quite yet, but if you want to just speak to it as if it's been amended, maybe that's okay. What's your preference, Representative Tamar?
I'll speak to it as if it's been amended.
Okay.
That's okay.
Okay.
Oh, I got to put glasses on.
Madam Chair and members of the Tax Committee, this is a bill that I think that the legislature and the governor can support, even though we're talking about income tax increases. Simply, this bill rolls back the income tax cuts that were made in 1999 and 2000 for those individuals who benefited the most from those cuts. It does not create a new tax bracket that was higher than we had in 2000. And it doesn't roll back the cuts for low and moderate income taxpayers. What I'm trying to accomplish is to reinstate what I believe was a more progressive income tax system that we had prior to 1999 and 2000 by adjusting some of the tax brackets. I voted for the tax cuts in 1999 and 2000. I made a mistake with that vote, and it's a mistake that I regret. And I'd have to say, those of you who were around here at the time, we had multiple years of tax surpluses, and we had the finance commissioner, and we were hearing it over and over again that we had boatloads of money, as it was referred to. And I confess, I drank the Kool-Aid, and I wished I hadn't. I mistakenly assumed that in times of trouble, the legislature and the governor would do the right thing and revisit the tax cuts and make the necessary adjustments. That hasn't happened, and I believe it should. In 1999 and 2000, we had three tax brackets, 6%, 8%, and 8.5%. And as you know, under current law, we have three tax brackets, 5.35%, 7.5%, and 7.85%. What this bill does, and what I'm proposing, is that we stay with the current law with the 5.35 tax bracket, the 7.5% tax bracket, but we would create a new tax bracket and reinstate the 8.5 rate that we had prior to 2000. The new 8% rate on $100,000 would be below the starting point for the 8.5% rate. This new bracket is between 7.5 and 8.5% and captures those who benefited the most over the past 10 years from the 99-2000 tax cuts. The 8% rate for income earners over $100,000 roughly corresponds to the 10th population decile in the Department of Revenue's tax incident study. The change would raise about $462 million for the biennium. That's not nearly as much as a full rollback, and it's not nearly as much as a new high bracket tax rate, but I think it's something the public would believe is fair. And some might question an income tax increase in a time of recession, but I would argue that this is exactly the right time. This is precisely the time when we need to invest in our state. And with that, I'd like Nan Madden, if I could, Madam Chair, who is the director of the Minnesota Budget Project, to address the committee.
Okay, and if I may, Ms. Madden, just a moment. We have a quorum, so I'm going to go ahead and move House File 1998 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And then I'll also move for Representative Tamar his amendment, which is the H-199-82 amendment Discussion of amendment. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. Motion carried. The amendment is adopted. Ms. Madden, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Nan Madden. I'm Director of the Minnesota Budget Project. We are an initiative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, and we provide independent research, analysis, and advocacy on budget and tax issues, with particular attention to the impact that fiscal decisions have on low and moderate income Minnesotans. We all know that Minnesota is facing a severe budget deficit, and we believe that a balanced approach to the deficit, an approach that makes changes on both the spending and tax sides of the budget, makes sense. Only through such a balanced approach will we be able to maintain adequate funding for education, health care, and other services that are more important than ever in these tough economic times. I know you've been spending some time in this committee with the tax incidence study, and it has been showing us that Minnesota's tax system has become more regressive, with a significant jump in regressivity between 2004 and 2006. We encourage you to consider including House File 1998 as one component of an omnibus tax bill that both helps address the deficit shortfall and addresses the rising regressivity of a tax system. It takes a targeted approach to raising revenues and focuses on the fact that the highest income Minnesotans paid less other incomes in total state and local taxes than other Minnesotans do. In 2006, those Minnesotans with household incomes roughly $448,000 a year and up paid 9.8% of their income in state and local taxes, while the average for all Minnesotans was 11.2%. Another key finding in the tax incidence study is that taxes today are a smaller share of Minnesotans' income than they were in the past. For example, in the mid-90s, the average amount that Minnesotans paid in total state and local taxes was close to 13%. And again, in 2006, it was 11.2%. I don't think we need to go all the way back to where we were in the mid-90s, but it does suggest that we might have cut taxes too deeply to be able to maintain the adequate spending and services that Minnesotans depend on. I think that there's a real opportunity in this legislative session to enact reforms so that we'll leave this legislative session with a better tax system than we have right now. We can improve our tax system so that taxes are raised more fairly and that our revenues are adequate to fund the services that Minnesotans expect. And we've also passed out a letter in support of this legislation from Brian Rushi of the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. He was not able to be here today. And he also asked to share with you these wallet cards. I think some of you might have the blue version. This is now on the new tax incidence study that shows the key findings of the study in a handy format. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Mann. Is there anyone from the public who would like to testify for or against this bill? Okay, if not, committee discussion, questions for Representative Tamar, Rep. Crawford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Tamar, you are an honest legislator. You're a good government guy, so I'm going to throw you the easiest of softballs, right? As everybody on this committee knows, when you factor in all taxes, the highest income tax brackets pay a higher percentage of their income in taxes than the middle and lower classes. Everybody knows that. Being an honest legislator, can you explain to me how, when looking at all taxes, when you've got the highest incomes paying the highest percentage of their income in taxes, how can it be argued that raising taxes on the people who have the highest percentage of their income being paid in taxes is fair?
Representative Tamar, are you honest, by the way, first of all? Representative Tamar.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I think we've made the case for what has happened in the last 10 years. When I'm speaking specifically about the income tax cuts and the percentage that higher income people pay relative to their income, and what low and moderate income people pay. I mean, it's just a case of fairness, and all I'm trying to do is bring us back to what I think was a more progressive tax rate back in 1999.
Representative Grapple.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Tamar, it just dawned on me that maybe perhaps your colleagues have misinformed you on this, but maybe you don't know what I just informed you of, and that is that, in fact, when we factor in all taxes, the people who this tax increase would affect already pay a higher percentage of their income in taxes then do any other bracket. And it's not even debatable.
Mm-hmm.
I'm amazed at the misconceptions. And Representative Primar, I've got the numbers right here, the latest numbers from the Congressional Budget Office, nonpartisan. When you look at them and you look at the differential between the top 1, top 5, top 10, top 20 compared to the lowest quintile, it's not even close. There's simply no way to compensate. So I'm trying to understand, either to the testifier or Representative Tamar, how can people keep repeating something that is not true? It is a fact.
Representative Garoppolo?
Yeah.
Representative Tamar, you want to respond?
Well, I trust it's factoring in the federal.
Yes. Representative Tamar, I think Representative Garoppolo, you want to clarify for Representative Tamar you're adding in the federal tax?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Tamar, when I say all taxes, I mean all taxes. And when we look at the latest February forecast, 25% of state funds come from federal sources. So to pretend that, you know, these numbers don't exist and these taxes aren't being paid is not honest. And as an honest legislator, I just simply request that you acknowledge that fact.
I'm just, Madam Chair, I'd like my witness, who's can probably explain this in a better way, to represent both for Ottawa.
Ms. Mann, just a minute. You can go ahead and answer this, but we'll all ask the Department of Revenue to come down. They can tell us what page of the tax incidence report that the Department of Revenue shows what the top bracket pays. Now, we're in a debate in federal and state, but of course your bill is for state taxes, not federal. But Ms. Mann.
Madam Chair, Representative Garoppolo, I think I have tried to be very careful to declare that what I'm referring to is the state and local tax system together. I understand that the results look different if you add in federal dollars. I guess the argument that I would make is the fact that we have a progressive tax system on the federal level does not mean that we should not try to address regressivity on the state and local system.
Representative Rupagina, to that point, to Representative Garoppolo's point.
Madam Chair, Representative Garoppolo, let me get this straight. You said all taxes.
Madam Chair, Representative Rupagina, absolutely.
You
all
said
taxes.
All taxes.
All taxes.
Representative Garoppolo, did you hit your head this morning or last week? Because are you talking the payroll tax?
Representative Rupagina, I'm talking about the federal income tax, the FICA tax, both sides of it, the Medicare tax, 9/11 security fee. I'm talking all taxes. All taxes.
Representative Garoppolo,
if
you consider the fact that probably, 90, I don't even know what it would be, but I would say, you know, 9 out of the 10 of us at this table have never reached the maximum payment on where we don't have to pay FICA taxes anymore.
I do.
That if you factor that in, and any of you that do, raise your hand. You should be proud of the fact that you make that kind of money. Right. Good for you. And Phil didn't raise his hand, but I know.
Just because I'm sitting next to him doesn't mean that I'm not
but
raising your
hand. Sir, when you figure that in, there's no way I can honestly believe what you're saying. I don't think you're being honest, because it just wouldn't have to make any sense. But you know, maybe we can get our tax people to say, when you factor in the fact that 6.5% comes right off the top of almost everybody we know is checked, but a few, that there's no way that you can tell me that is a true statement.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, this is totally awesome. It actually dawned on me. You're serious. I thought you guys were misleading me. You're actually serious. You think I'm not telling
you? This bill deals with
Representative Rupagina, did you hear his question there, Representative Graff? Do you want to repeat that? I think you guys are not listening to each other, so I'm just trying to get you to actually hear each other.
Madam Chair, you brought up the point of the Social Security and Medicare tax. In the Medicare is paid by everything. Social Security is 6.2%. The bottom federal bracket is 10%. The top bracket is 35%. Even if you account for the 6.2%, there's still almost 19% of bracket differential. The CBO numbers are right here. The top 1% in the latest numbers from 2005 pay a 31.2% off of growth, not taxable, off of growth, so it's an accurate number. The bottom quintile is 4.3%. No matter how you manipulate the state numbers, you can never possibly argue that the richest 1, 5, 10, 20, or 40% pay a lower percentage of their income in taxes than the bottom bracket. It is totally false. And to say, well, we don't have this jurisdiction over federal matters. 25% of the funds spent in this state
come from several sources. If I went to you and said, we have a progressive tax structure in Minnesota, because look at the income tax. You'd say, no, Representative Groffler, you can't look at one tax. You got to look at them all. And that's exactly what I'm arguing. You got to look at all the taxes. But you're serious. You really didn't know this before I mentioned it?
Matt,
Representative Rucamina.
They hire their Philadelphia lawyers so they don't pay any taxes.
Representative Groffler.
Are you talking before or after they buy municipal bonds, et cetera, where they don't pay any taxes? Are you talking before that, or are you just taking it across the board?
Madam Chair, Representative Rucamina, I am using the numbers that people pay in taxes. Now, we can go out to fairyland and pretend about taxes they should be paying in an alternative universe, but the reality is under the AMT tax, at a certain point, you just got to pay the tax under AMT, right? So, I mean, you can argue that the federal tax law should be, and I'm sure that President Obama and the Congress are going to be addressing those issues, but if people are going to get here and argue that the richest don't pay a fair percentage of their income in taxes, it is a lie. It is false. The richest 1, 5, 10, and 20% pay a higher percentage of their income in taxes than the lower and middle classes. And that is a fact. And the fact that there is so much silence from the other side of the aisle on this is the second time this has happened, it proves that I'm right. And if someone can just show me the data proving otherwise, I'll happily admit I'm wrong.
I do live in an alternate world. I'm like a bizarro, I guess. But I know what you're saying. It's not. I don't believe that what you're saying is anywhere near the truth, because I know what you hired a Philadelphia lawyer with the bottom line.
Okay, so Representative Garofalo, we have a number of people to this point, and we're way off Representative Tamar, so. But Representative Garofalo, go ahead.
Madam Chair, the handout we got from the testifier is effective in a nice little card. I'm going to make up my own card, by the way, which we're showing the numbers. effective tax rate by decile. And I understand that if you exclude certain taxes and you only look at part of the picture, you can make this argument. But Representative Rucamina, you would admit, it would be dishonest for me to sit here and say, well, if we look at the income tax, clearly Minnesota has a progressive tax because look at the income tax. You'd say no. You have to look at all the taxes paid. Likewise, if you're talking about fairness and percentage of income, you have to look at all taxes paid. The February forecast, one out of every $4 in this state, the state government, came from federal sources. It simply cannot be argued.
Okay, I'm going to go to that point, which is David Van Murphy Van Fulbert. I do want to give Representative Paymar, the author of this bill, a chance to speak. But I do want to point out that this little card does say state and local taxes on it. But I should tell members that we're on House Bill 1998, which if you actually look at the bill, this is amending Minnesota statutes. It's not amending federal law. And we can only change state tax law. I know people are really upset about the state and federal combined, and I think Representative Garofalo has a very good point here. States, however, don't get to change federal law. Try as we might. But there's a lot I'd like to change, but we don't get to. So individual legislators will decide if that means they have to line up their state tax code to compensate for the feds or not. I mean, I'm not one who feels I need to do that, but some here do. So we're going to have Representatives David, Murphy, Solberg, and Broad. But I do want to say, I do think, just on the facts of the feds, okay, but this is not what this bill is about. I think Representative Garofalo is right. Okay? He's right about when you take the federal and state. We're not the Congress. We're the state. So I don't want to waste too much time on whether Representative Garofalo is right on the state component, but to just get the argument over with here so we can get back to the bill, if I may ask Ms. Manzie to come to the table just for a minute and ask a nonpartisan person to sort of comment on the federal income tax combined, or the all taxes and the state taxes combined. Is it right that in your mind that what Representative Garofalo is portraying is relatively accurate here? So I mean, I know you don't want to weigh in on members, but I don't think Representative Rucamina is right or wrong, or Representative Garofalo. We're talking about different things here, but Ms. Manzie, can you talk to us a little bit about the progressivity of the federal tax code for all taxes and fees and the Minnesota taxes and fees combined? Ms. Manzie.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that the cards that were distributed to you show what the Tax Incident Study has found for the Minnesota tax system. It doesn't include, you referenced fees in your question. I don't think that includes fees, and I don't think anyone has done an analysis of how fees are distributed by population decile. I have not looked recently for any studies that combine all federal taxes and all state taxes. So I can't speak to the overall progressivity of the federal system. My suspicion is that Representative Garofalo is correct that the overall federal system is progressive and more progressive than the state system, simply because the federal income tax provides such a dominant source of funding at the federal level. And he's correct that the top federal rate is 35% currently. The bottom rate is 10%. That's a much greater difference than the difference between the state's top rate of 7.85% and bottom rate of 5.35%. One point I would add is that state income taxes are deductible at the federal level. So for federal high income taxpayers who are not subject to the federal alternative minimum tax, the proposal in House File 1998 would increase the amount of state income taxes that they could deduct and as a result decrease their federal income tax liability. So the cost to someone who's not subject to the federal alternative minimum tax would be, and was in the very top federal bracket, would be 65 cents on the dollar, because 35 cents would translate into reduced federal taxes. Now that's not true for someone who is on the AMT, which has a top federal rate of 28%, because the state income taxes are not deductible from the federal alternative minimum tax.
Okay, Ms. Manzi, and while you're there, are there any states that have a more progressive income tax than the federal income tax?
Madam Chair, I haven't looked at that in recent days either, but in looking at other states' income taxes in the past, my impression has been that very few states have a state income tax that is anywhere near as progressive as Minnesota's. And given that impression, I would have to say that I don't think there are any states that have a state income tax that's anywhere near as progressive as the federal income tax.
Okay. Thank you so much. Representative Kamar, you want to, before we go to that point, respond to some of this? Just trying to keep people on the state taxes now.
Everything that Ms. Manzi said is exactly what I was going to say.
Nicely done. So I in Richland, Tamar, you know, this has been a recurring theme, I think, a little bit in tax community, and I think, you know, there are those who are addressing the federal issue. You know, we're the Minnesota state tax and local committee, but did you want to...
No, I just, you know, I think people know what I'm trying to do here. I mean, it's fairly obvious. I said I was here back in 99 and 2000 when we made these cuts. I think, in retrospect, it was wrong. We are going to raise taxes this year, Madam Chair and members. The question is whether we're going to do it progressively or regressively, and that's what this bill is trying to accomplish. It doesn't raise the kind of revenue that I think that we need, but it's my best attempt to try to do something that's fair and that I hope the legislature would consider and that the governor might consider.
Thank you. Representative David.
Well, Madam Chair, I just feel that what we have here is a failure to communicate. and with that, I think I'm going to pass.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, I think this is the third time we've had this discussion in committee about the federal tax code and the state tax code. And we have a big job to do before us, and I get that, you know, it's important that we have the full picture, but maybe we could figure out some sort of hand signal or way to stipulate that Representative Garofalo wants to make sure we understand that point of view, so we don't have to spend 10 minutes of committee time and impugning somebody's integrity, so we can just move on through it and get to the work. So just, if you want help working on a hand signal, I'd work on it with you.
Madam Chair, and to my friend Representative Murphy, just to be clear, I'm not impugning anyone's motives or integrity. I'm not doing that. But I have been very deliberative in this committee. I have not brought this argument forward unless people have used the word fairness. I do not bring it up just arguing the numbers willy-nilly. It's only until either testifiers or committee members talk about fairness. And my point is, if you're talking about fairness,
You cannot argue that the top 1, 2, 5, 10, or 20% pay a lower percentage of their income in taxes because they don't.
Okay, Representative Herbert Brad Downey.
You know, I'll pass.
That's Sam Brad. Hi, Brad.
I might first sermon with that, but I'll pass.
That's Sam Brad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think if we're going to talk about state taxes, we should talk about state taxes, but yet every time that we have this discussion, we end up talking about local taxes, too. So I think Representative Garofalo is right in that if we're going to talk about state and local taxes, we didn't run for city council. Some of us used to serve on the city council or on the county board or on the school district. But if we're going to talk about what we do as a state policy related to income taxes or other taxes, then we ought to talk about it as such. And when you start bringing in local taxes, then I think it's fair to start bringing in the federal taxes, and that's the only argument that related to fairness that I think we need to keep in mind too. When you take out the local taxes in the tax incident study, we have a progressive system, and so I think that as we consider fairness, we need to consider all the pieces of the puzzle. And I thank Representative Garofalo for his tenaciousness related to that. But Representative Paymire, the question related to at what income level people will start to see an increase. And the way I read your language of the bill, or the way I'm reading the House research summary, is that at $56,000, these folks who are deemed to have not paid their fair share are going to start seeing an increase in their taxes in 2009 or 2010.
Representative Paymar, or if you want to ask Ms. Mandy to get the years straight on when, what things, and the members recall fiscal years and tax years are different, so it's a little confusing.
Madam Chair and Representative Brad, I think Ms. Mandy can get you the exact, this is a little, it's a 56.
Ms. Mandy.
I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, I think the question may be more about filing status than about tax years and fiscal years. And in designing this bill, Representative Paymar worked to focus the increase on the top deciles, the top population deciles in the incident study that we were working with at the time, which was the 2007 incident study. And there's a sort of a tension between how the incident study reports income data and how the income tax works, because the income tax brackets are adjusted by filing status, and the ratios used for splitting, what Representative Paymar's bill does is it splits the current 7.05% bracket into two parts, and the lower part continues to have the 7.05% rate, and then the upper part gets the 8% rate. The upper part was set at $100,000 for married couples filing jointly to match it up to the top, I think the ninth decile in the incident study. When you adjust that for the other filing statuses, you reach down to lower incomes. And what we don't know from the incident study is how many people in each of those deciles file which way. So we don't know how many single filers are in that top decile and how many married filers are in that top decile. And our other brackets are also not set, you know, tied to the incident study. They're set at income levels. Typically, we talk about the income level they're at for a married joint filer, and then we adjust it for the other filers, where the married separate bracket is half of the married joint bracket. The head of household bracket is probably around 78 to 79% of the married joint bracket, and then the single bracket is in between the 50 and the 78%. So what you're seeing with the 56,000 is the effect on single filers, and I think that that would reach down into the seventh decile if there are, you know, for where the single filers are. Of course, what we don't know is where the single filers are in those deciles.
So, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Manzi, it's fair to say then that tax increases will be forthcoming for folks potentially at incomes of $56,000 and above.
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, that's correct. And that, again, the same bracket ratios were used with the tax changes that occurred in 1998 and 1999. So this is not something new where the brackets are adjusted by filing status.
Right. And Mr. Chairman and Ms. Manzi, I appreciate the clarification. I mean, we should be talking about this in the realm of who potentially could see a tax increase, and the same folks who are potentially going to see a tax increase in the amount of potentially 311,000 returns, 354,000 returns in 2010, according to the revenue analysis. These are the same folks that we're trying to pull into public programs. And these are the people we're going to call rich. These are the people that we're going to increase taxes on in this state of Minnesota. There's some disparity in thought between those two things that needs to be addressed. And so talking about it in the realm of rolling back is interesting, I suppose, but it comes down to the fact that we are going to potentially increase taxes if your bill were to pass, Representative Tamar, on people earning $56,000, pure and simple. The good news is you want to tax the rich, the bad news is you're rich.
Mr. Chair, I think
Representative Tamar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, the Department of Revenue estimate does cite an estimate of 311,300 returns in tax year 2009 that would have a tax increase, and then that increases to 354,400 returns. Now, they made those estimates using the 2006 sample of individual income tax returns and the growth assumptions of the February forecast from 2006 to 2009 and 2010. They also share with the legislature and with Minnesota Management and Budget a version of that income tax sample that is the same sample that they use, except it has the records in the very high income ranges blurred or undersampled for us so that we can't identify who taxpayers are and violate their confidentiality. So when I model this proposal, I get slightly different results than when the Department of Revenue does, because they have more detail for high-end taxpayers than I do. But when I model it, I do want to point out that it's about one-fifth of the people affected by the increase have incomes below $100,000, and then remaining approximately four-fifths have incomes over $100,000. And like the incident study, that's putting all filer types together into those income clumps. So that just provides a little more insight into how the increase would be distributed.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Bob, we'll do one more follow-up. We've got Representative Downey waiting, and I know we want to hear from the Department of Revenue as well. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, the Department might be able to help answer my question, too. I'm wondering how this changes the regressivity or the progressivity of our system. I remember Dr. Wilson came up and said you have to make a pretty big leap to impact the SUTH index to any significant manner. And so I'm curious how this would impact the SUTH index going forward, because, Representative Tamar, if you increase taxes 400,000 in this manner, there's still a target of $1.3 billion that this committee has to come up with. So all those 1.3 by default would have to come from regressive sources, and so I'm wondering if it mitigates or removes any progressivity that you're going to achieve in other manners.
Of course, it's probably a bigger question than you're prepared to answer. But
Representative Broad, look, we have a huge challenge on our hands. I'm not suggesting I have the answer here, and I suspect the committee is going to hear a number of different tax proposals, some that would raise a lot more revenue. Income tax proposal, some that would raise a lot more revenue than my bill would. I said that in my opening remarks, that this does not raise as much as some of the other proposals. The tax committee is going to have to make those decisions. And this is a difficult time. I hope we're up to the challenge. To get to $1.5 billion in revenue is going to require this committee as well as the legislature to approve some regressive taxes. I totally get that. But we have to have this discussion now, and this is a good start. I don't believe that we can cut our way out of this budget deficit without causing the state an enormous amount of pain, without causing huge job losses, without causing programs that are to be eliminated. and to not force the quality of life in the state to be reduced, which I think it will if we don't raise some revenue. Now, those may just be some philosophical differences that you and I might have, but if we don't have the debate, if we don't have an honest intellectual discussion about it, we're not going to move forward. I think the taxpayers of this state expect us to do this. I don't know what's going to happen at the end of the day.
Thank you, Representative Tamar. Representative Downey, to this point, or do you want to hear from the Department of Revenue first?
Actually, to this point.
Representative Downey, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So what's interesting and a little frustrating to me is that over the last few years, statewide taxes have been raised in an extremely regressive manner. We've got a sales tax for the stadium. We raised the gas tax and other transportation taxes that are ultimately regressive. We just put a statewide sales tax on for a number of other things this past year, the tune of $200+ million. And so what we've done in the legislature is make our tax system far more regressive in the last 4 years. And so now the strategy to make it progressive is to continue to add taxes on the other end as compared to providing tax relief for the lower end of the continuum. So I find it ironic that the very tax measures that have made it so much more regressive we're now trying to compensate for with additional taxes as compared to just keeping our spending under control. And we don't know each other at all, but I would really disagree strongly with the notion that somehow living within a budget that would frankly be the exact same as what we had in 2006-2007 budget year somehow regresses Minnesota to the dark ages. We could, by living within our means on a 2006-2007 budget, pay for everything that we did back then, and I don't think we were living in the worst place in the world then. But my question, if I could, with that as a comment, is do we have any evidence that a more progressive tax structure actually leads to increased state revenues? Because I know there's a tipping point at which individuals will start to make different decisions, not do business in the state, leave the state, do different things with their money to avoid those taxes. Mm-hmm. And the reality is, I think, if the Minnesota Chamber number that I heard was accurate, some 92% of businesses actually file as pass-through entities in this state. So this tax increase that we're talking about here is going to hit a lot of small businesses. And as we've heard from a lot of testimony, business taxation ultimately goes back to consumers and is ultimately regressive in nature, although hidden in the cost of products that consumers buy. So I'm not sure if it's a question for Mr. Michael or for the testifiers, but do we have any evidence that the states that have the most progressive tax structures actually generate more revenue to cover state expenses or not?
Thank you, Representative. Let's start with research. Ms. Manzi or Mr. Michael? Ms. Manzi?
Representative Downey, I'll take a stab at that, and then Mr. Michael may have something to add. I'm not aware of any studies that provide information on when an income tax rate increase at the upper end causes businesses to leave a state and go somewhere else. I think I'll stop with that. I think that they obviously have to take a lot of factors into consideration in making location decisions.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, members, I would echo what Ms. Manzi said. I'm not aware of any studies that address that specifically. There are studies that focus exclusively on business tax, on corporation tax. The difficulty with an individual income tax is most of it is on individual wages and salaries and interest and dividends and so forth. And so it's sort of, I just have never seen a study that focused on the sort of sole proprietor partnership S-corp element of the business tax and the rate sensitivity elasticity.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. Representative Feldberg?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, I've heard several times the statement. Well, I'll just go back to 2006 and 7, or 2005 and 6, I think it's like, and just do the 6. I have that drafted for you, and in the type of targets that you would need to have for each of the spending, and I invite you to offer that.
Representative?
I invite you to offer the cuts in K-12 education and higher education and others to meet that target.
Representative Downey? Actually, Representative Coles offered a resolution that I signed on to, and a number of other colleagues that actually did just that. Now, we chose to prioritize slightly differently, and so the cuts weren't necessarily to K-12 education. We made many of the prioritization decisions that current House leadership is also making. So living within that overall budget target of 31 point something billion, we're able to do quite a lot, actually. So I would welcome the opportunity, frankly, to take it further, but we've already got a resolution doing essentially the same thing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, the resolution that was introduced is just the two parts of it. The overall spending, or the three parts, overall spending, the reserve, and the cash flow. I've missed the fourth part, which is the target. I haven't seen them come from anybody, but I did do the work on that, and going back to the sixth, and we were still $700 million short from where we're at in our forecast.
Thank you, Representative Fillmore, any wrap-up comments?
No, Mr. Chair, I think I've made the point, and hope that the Tax Committee will consider this as they move forward.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Members will be laying this bill over for possible inclusion. Representative Carlson, are you ready to go next?
Where am I?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am. And
welcome.
Enjoyed the, by the way, the animated discussion a while ago. It reminded me of my first term on taxes back in the early 70s when we had a big debate on the taxation of oleomargarine. And we had a dairy farmer on the committee that would have made Representative Grosswall appear to be very quiet and reserved. He jumped to his feet, and his chair went flying back, and he said, "This is a fraud." Well, this bill, by the way, is not done. But I just happened to think of that when things got a little animated a few moments ago, if I could digress for a quick moment. Mr. Chairman, we do have an amendment that's included in the packets, and so, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the amendment to put the bill in the order that we'd like to present it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the A1 amendment.
Representative Carlson, do you want to speak to the amendment?
Well, I can. That's the way I'd like to present the bill. So the amendment will, in essence, become the bill. And this bill eliminates the lag in the fiscal disparities tax rates calculation. The goal of the bill is to make fiscal disparities more responsive to current economic conditions rather than having a lag. The bill delays implementation until 2014, so there's no fiscal impact as a result of that delay, as you'll see with your note, revenue note. And the administrative auditor, which is in Oca County, will make recommendations if additional changes are needed to be made as a result of the change in the lag in terms of determining the tax. So, Mr. Chairman, that's two things. That's the bill and the amendment. There has been some work to achieve a compromise. At one time, the bill, as it was originally drafted, would have included a fiscal disparities program on the Iron Range. That's been removed just as a result of the amendment, so it would be the metropolitan area only. And then, as I mentioned earlier, there's a longer delay than what was originally in the bill. But I have Lona Schreiber with me, and if you'd like to have her comment before you vote on the amendment.
Why don't we get the bill in order? You prefer Representative Carlson, and then we can take testifiers and committee discussion. So, members, Representative Carlson moves 923 for possible inclusion, and then moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment passes. Representative Carlson, your testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Lona Schreiber. I'm the Intergovernmental Coordinator for Anoka County. And as Representative Carlson said, we are the administrative auditor. And that means we do the calculation. We do all the figuring as it relates to the fiscal disparity. And the process that's been used up to now has never been changed or really looked at. And it was started originally without as much electronic capacity as we have now. And there is the one-year lag. And it wasn't our proposal, but we were asked to, we had two meetings with staff, both in the House and the Senate side, and with Senator Rest. And because of your deadlines that are still in statute, especially as it relates to the truth and taxation notices, we wanted the time to try to work this through a different way. And Mr. Hines has been very, very helpful. And as you can see, by Section 4, we will be reporting back to the legislature as to how we can streamline this. But I think it's better that you do have a timely and not have that lag as far as what the distribution is. So we will try to work on it, and we're a willing partner here. That's the message.
Thank you, Ms. Schreiber. Representative, do you have anyone else you want to have speak?
Well, just to point out, as Ms. Schreiber did, that Steve Hines is available to answer any technical questions. This is a bill dealing with a technical issue with fiscal disparities. I'm probably the only one here that remembers much about the origin. I wasn't here when it was enacted, but it was one Charlie Weaver. Charlie Weaver Sr., not the Charlie Weaver of activities with the business community and so on of late, but that's his son. But it's originally authored by a state representative from Anoka County, and it was to bring about some fairness in the commercial industrial distribution of dollars between the communities in the Twin Cities metropolitan area.
Mm-hmm. Members, questions for Representative Carlson or his testifier? Representative Leffler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and either Ms. Min or Representative Carlson. I see that it moves some dates back and some dates forward, and I'm not quite sure how they all fit, but in terms of a municipality or a county that's trying to do its budgeting, will they have actual information about the effect of fiscal disparities earlier or later? I wasn't quite sure how to follow all the dates.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler.
That's a good one for Mr. Hines, who drafted the amendment.
Mr. Hines, welcome.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, the information should be available in the necessary time frame to do the work. It's kind of a different environment because they'll be getting a different kind of information. Up until now, or the way the system works now, they're given an amount of money that they're going to get from the fiscal disparities pool, and under this system they'll be informed of how much tax base they're going to be getting from the pool, which they'll combine with their own tax base before they determine their local rate. So it's kind of different kind of information. Part of the reason for the delay was to work through some of the issues and make sure there's lots of give and take between the counties and the Anoka County, the administrative auditor, of information going back and forth to get everything to flow. And they want to make sure that they can really make those pieces flow back and forth in a timely fashion. But it seems to me that it should be able to work out that they would have that information available if it's a little different kind of information.
Okay. Members, any other questions? Not. Representative Carlson renews his motion to... thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify on this? All right. Seeing that Representative Carlson renews his motion to have 923 laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Representative Gardner, are you ready to go?
Sure.
Welcome. Going to move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do have two amendments, actually, to put it in the shape I'd like it if someone could move the bill. I'll move the bill, 1584. That it be held over for possible inclusion. I'm going to move the amendments, Mr. Chair, and we'll put it in the right shape.
Wait.
I have... let me do the one that's in your packet already, the H-1854-A1, because the original bill just leaves the number of, there's a threshold number of cubic feet and kilowatt hours blank. And now I'm inserting some numbers, so that would be the 1854-A1 amendment, to make that number 300. That might be a little confusing, but the idea is to make it 300 CCF, with CCF being 100 cubic feet of gas. 750 kilowatt hours.
Okay. Members, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. A1 amendment passes.
And then, Mr. Chair, I'd move the A09-0364 amendment, which I think everybody has now. I worked with the Multi-Housing Association on this to make sure that we were talking about per dwelling units, so that we weren't talking about whole apartment buildings or multi-unit housing.
Okay. There's a discussion on the AA09 amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. The AA09 amendment passes as well. To your bill, as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1584 is an attempt to narrow the sales tax exemption that was set up for home heating fuel during the heating season, which is roughly November to April. Mr. Michael told me of the history behind this, that former Speaker Irv Anderson wanted to not burden people who are of modest means during the heating season, and so we have a home heating fuel sales tax exemption. So we exempt three different things: electricity when your primary source of heat is electric heat, natural gas when your primary source is natural gas, and all the miscellaneous stuff, which is liquid propane, fuel oil, coal. I don't know anybody who uses coal anymore, wood, and a variety of other things. What I'm suggesting is that if the intent was to ease the burden for people of modest means, we now have billing and metering technology to help us isolate those people better. And so I'm suggesting narrowing the exemption for just the first basic block of energy that people need during the winter for electric heat and natural gas. So that's how you get the number 300 feet of cubic gas or cubic feet of natural gas during the winter, and 750 kilowatts of electric heat during the winter. We have the tax expenditure survey shows that we forego about $160 million in tax revenue a year, or $320 million during the biennium through that exemption. We did get a revenue estimate about 2 hours ago that this bill would bring in roughly $4.7 to $4.9 million in 2010-2011, so it's actually a much smaller fraction than I was expecting, but that's fine. Arizona and Maine have something similar to this. Maine exempts them for 750 kilowatt hours a month for electricity. The streamlined sales and use tax agreement specifically exempts energy, so you can set up tiered rates for energy as opposed to other things. The assumptions in the revenue estimate I think would affect where the revenue is at for this. They're assuming 20% of customer use on gas is above 300 cubic feet per CCF. 7.5% of electrical heat users would use more than the threshold I have in there. It makes me think if it might be more precise to just junk the exemption altogether and then give a credit on people's income taxes, but that's certainly a possibility. Questions that have come up when I was developing this idea during the session and talking with researchers and some of the utilities even today was, will we catch too many people in the net of removing the taxation that maybe are struggling? There's the prototypical grandmother in the leaky house who might be using more energy than what's on here who would pay sales tax. I haven't had anybody actually give me any indication that that would be true or not. I was kind of expecting utilities to show me something like deciles of energy use and figuring out how many people are actually using over a certain amount of energy, but I haven't seen that yet. I'm also a little concerned that the existing tax exemption for electric heat may not be, utilities may not be fully in compliance with that. I did talk to one utility that said they do code their customers to see who actually has electric heat so that they don't charge them the sales tax, but other utilities said that they were not sure, they didn't know if they did that as well. Mr. Chair, members of the bill, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Representative Gardner. Representative Broad.
Thank you. Representative Gardner, I don't know how efficiencies work at all. I was just thinking about the differences between fuel, oil, coal, wood, steam, hot water, and I was kind of relating it to animal units. You know, each animal type has a different type of animal unit that goes along with it. And I'm wondering, do all these types of gas, do they have the same efficiencies, or do they have different efficiencies? I'm just trying to figure out who actually is going to end up getting the opportunity to pay more, and who's going to, because it's hard to even ask the question. But.
Sure.
Representative
Broad, to be quite honest, I focused on electricity and natural gas as they are listed in the exemption because they're metered.
Mm-hmm.
And metering technology is quite good. I don't know how you'd measure, you know, the BTU efficiency per square foot or cubic foot for wood, for example. You know, have a different wood stove that has different examples. That's not covered by this bill, however.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to keep it simple for the stuff that it's metered for. I actually have an uncle in Maine who uses wood stove. And I was just thinking, this isn't particularly effective, but the house is so old, that's just the way they had it set up. But I don't know if you're looking to push people in the right direction for having a more efficient system, or...
Well...
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Gardner. I guess I don't want to push people in any direction. I'm just trying to understand, like, again, you know, whether 300 cubic feet of one is the same as 300... I guess that's the easier way of asking it. 300 cubic feet of one is the same as 300 cubic feet of the other. Maybe because it's the outcome of those different variations of energy, maybe it is. And that's all I'm trying to understand.
Mr. Representative Broad, you know, to try and come to some level of precision on this is actually very difficult. If you can have a modern house that's fairly large, that might be as efficient as one that's half the size, that's 30 years old. There is software out there that some utilities are using in Minnesota as a pilot project to use publicly available assessor data that uses the age of the home and the square footage and that kind of data, and then integrates it with usage data, and then they send you a report to say whether you're above average or below average in your use for similar types of houses. And as I described that to people, some are a little creeped out at that. you've got the private usage data and the public assessor data is combined, but only the user actually gets it. And they actually have seen people reduce their energy consumption in areas where they've tried this in other parts of the country. That's the only example I know of where you're trying to integrate other data to, you know, it's like one big regression analysis to try and figure out what variables do you put in this. This age of the home, number of people in the house, medical condition of the people in the house, and it gets a little creepy if you try to get that precise. And so I'm trying to keep it a little simple with what I have here.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Just a follow-up. Thank you, Representative Gardner. I think that would be creepy to a lot of people. Do you have any sense of, from a geographical standpoint, who is taking advantage of this right now that wouldn't be able to take advantage of it? Is there any way to get that type of information? I don't know if the department might have that information.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barada, the Department of Commerce might be the best tool, but I was actually hoping the utilities might give me some information of what the typical household is that uses a certain amount of information. I think my assumption, and I could be wrong, is that a lot of suburban households that are really large are the ones that use it. That's one reason I wanted to have the hearing, to see if some of the utilities would come forward and give me some indication of whether that's really true or not, and I haven't seen it yet.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. Representative Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gardner, several questions or comments about this. I presume that there's no factor here for dual heating.
Representative Gardner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, that's correct. I my dad has a house where he's got two different kinds of fuel. He's actually got two furnaces, I'm sorry to say, but one's fuel oil and one isn't. And I think that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, it seems to me that we ought, as a government, ought to be encouraging dual heating. And my city did that. A lot of utilities have around the country, and so I have a little bit of a problem when we're in effect going to be taxing folks who are doing what we want them to do in terms of dual heating. Secondly, it seems to me that the levels of 300 cubic feet per month or 750 are pretty low for average customers, especially if electric heat is involved. And so I guess I'm wondering if you have any data that points to what the average consumption is on either one of those. And the other thing, and I'll let you respond, I would wonder about the difficulty that some of the utilities, especially municipal utilities, would have in maybe a situation where one month they would have the tax and the next month they wouldn't. And I'm wondering if that wouldn't pose some real practical logistical problems for some utilities. Maybe it doesn't for the great big utilities, but for the smaller utilities, it seems to me that could be problematic. And I haven't heard from anyone, but it's a question anyway that comes to mind as we look at this. Thank you,
Representative Gardner. Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, I appreciate the comments in the revenue estimate. The assumption is that 20% of customers use over 300 cubic feet per month. And I have got an intern who was helping me with this, and we actually could not find a good number. And so I'd like to see where that comes from. But it's also assumed that the average use is 2,500 cubic feet per month. So people would only be taxed on that extra 25. And on electric heat, the assumption is that 7.5% of residential users of electricity are using over 750 with electric heat as a primary source. Now, if those numbers change, if someone can demonstrate that, and I'm going to keep looking, if those numbers aren't right, that changes the revenue estimate and how you do it. But I tried in vain to try and find out around the country just what those numbers are. They're very different in different places. So in Maine, they use a lot of fuel oil, not natural gas. In Minnesota, they use more natural gas. And, of course, we're colder for longer, and we're less humid. So it creates a lot of different dynamics that are hard to deal with. Just looking at the revenue estimate that, for the next biennium, we might bring in $9 million out of the $320 million in the tax expenditure tells me that this isn't a huge amount, that this number is not too far off, but that's all I have to go on at the moment.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lanning, I was thinking about the same kind of issue about the difficulty of doing this as a practical matter for the utilities, but I just want to point out, you were talking about some doing it some months and not other months, but I just wanted to point out to you that current law apparently has it that way, that it's only the tax is only exemption during some months, so apparently it's being done. Now, I don't know, Representative Gardner, if you've given any thought to how difficult it is to, in terms of just their billing procedure, to put it in only over the amounts that you've got, but you know, if they're already switching it on and off on certain months, I assume that it's not all that hard to do. Maybe you could comment on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, you would be correct. I have Xcel, which is the largest utility in the state, but I also have the City of Circle Pines, which has its own municipal utility, and it's a little bit harder to work with it. But yeah, they are charging for your natural gas use at home during the summer for your stove and your oven. You're being charged a tax on it, but not starting in November and through April. So that would lead me to believe that either they're not complying or they are complying and they don't have any trouble with it.
Representatives, any other questions?
Representative Broad.
Just a quick question, and I don't know, Representative Gardner, if maybe this is better for Mr. Michael or not, but do renters have access to this credit?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, yes. If an apartment building, a residential apartment building, has, you know, they do not pay the... Whether it's billed to the landlord or to the tenant, they do not pay the sales tax on their home heating fuels for those covered months.
Thank you. Anybody else that in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Right. Seeing none, Representative Gardner, do you want to renew your motion?
Yes, I'll renew my motion that House File 1584, as amended, be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus House tax bill.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Bill?
Thanks for your attention.
Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Ryan. I don't know, is this for laid over for possible inclusion? So I'd like to move the House File 2217 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And members, this is about Cook County, which is Grand Marais. That's probably what you think of as Cook County the most, but it's the farthest, most northeastern county. And this bill firstly raises the cap on the amount that can be raised by local sales tax from 14 to 20 million. It also makes some changes in the definitions of its uses, which eliminates in the bill the use for a construction improvement of a single community center and recreation area and replaces it with authority to have multiple recreation and community centers across the county. It's a very, you know, it's a large, very sparsely populated county. The county has just over 5,000 residents in the entire county. It has more bears probably and more moose than it does people, but nonetheless it's real important to the state because of Lake Superior and the folks that live up there and the tourism opportunities. And they did a survey and they found that they needed recreation areas not centered in one location of such a large county, but possibly in other areas across the county. It also adds the language that would allow improvements to a community high-speed internet system, and also construction and improvements on their district energy plant, which they have a municipal utility there in the city of Grand Marais. And so that is the bill. I have no illusion that it will be in the Senate, in the House tax bill, because the chair always makes my senator pay for all of my bills. He happens to be the tax chair in the Senate, and she uses all of my bills as leverage against him because she knows that all of my bills will be in his bill. So, I'm here today to be sacrificed.
Thank you, Representative Bell. Members, questions, Representative Bell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, I just wanted to know, Representative Bell, if this is going to be the vehicle for the omnibus tax bill.
Well, Representative Chair, and Representative Broad, you know, the last time that happened, I didn't know it was happening either. So I can't say one way or the other, but it certainly could be used as that way, I suspect.
Anything's possible. Members, any other questions? Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bill, I know that this is currently authorized, but do you envision that if we were to add the local option county sales tax, that Cook County would take that up to?
Representative?
Well, first, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lanning. First off, this is authorized, but it still requires a referendum vote before the end of the year. And, you know, I can't answer that question. I don't know the answer to that question. I know they have a lodging tax, and, you know, the taxes there pale in comparison to the taxes, for example, if you rent a room or buy a drink in the Twin Cities, and so I mean, they might. I don't know the answer to that. And further, I don't know what the final dispensation and composition of the bill that is going to, you know, the end result will be on the, I think you're referring to the Marquardt tax, and I don't know what that's going to look like at the end of the process. I just know what I want this to look like. So the answer is they might.
Members, any other questions?
Anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, Representative Joe, do you want to renew your motion?
Yep, I'll renew my motion, Mr. Chair, that 2217 be laid over for possible inclusion.
All right. Thank you, Representative Dell. Members, while we wait for either Representative Hillstrom or Mellory, we can do a couple things. First of all, has anybody had a chance to look at the minutes from April 2nd and April 3rd?
Mr. Chairman, they look good so much.
All right. Representative Garofalo moves the minutes from April 2nd and April 3rd. All those in favor, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Minutes are approved. And I know there was a discussion from Friday, Representative Lanning, you had a handout that you were going to make sure everybody got a copy of, and we have those now, so I don't know if you have any additional comments you want to make, but the pages are going to get those distributed for us.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Groffel.
If Representative Lentesky's not coming back, I feel comfortable moving the 2172 bill. No? Unless she wants to be here for it, then...
What was her instruction?
That's her instruction, go to wait.
Okay. I could speak against House File 1105, if you get that out of the way.
Or we could just wait.
I think that's been withdrawn from our agenda.
1105 is?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Well, it's is that Farmington?
No, Mr. Chairman, members, it's the that's the raised property taxes on the Collier County. No, Township Full Saint Freeloaders, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
Seems reasonable.
You know what, though, Mr. Chairman, if we're indulging the committee, an interesting note about that bill is that the person who has authored that bill the last two sessions has lost the re-election. Transit taxing district curse.
From that area.
Huh?
From that area.
Yep.
And Seibert.
Who? Lloyd Seibert. So it's a transit taxing curse. I'm raising the specter for future members.
Do you live in that district?
Mr. Chair and Representative Selberg, I do not.
I was just
going to
see if we could make
the
most of the House
Party
after me.
I should have saw that one coming.
Just so you know, members, we're working on it. Representative Hillstrom is presenting and Representative Mullery is chairing. So,
Mr. Chairman, do we have another member of the majority party who's going to be move the bills and have staff? It's a Twins opener, Mr. Chairman.
I understand.
So.
I'm with you. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank staff, Mr. Michael and staff for putting together this TIF information. And I haven't seen this for a while, and I would encourage all members to take a look. But when you see some of these communities that have 47.4% and 30 some percent and 20 some percent, that's of concern. And maybe if we could ask Mr. Michael to comment on how precarious maybe some of these communities might be putting themselves in a bad position by having such a high percentage of their tax base that's captured in tax increments.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think actually one thing to note about that is that a lot of those cities that have the very high percentages tend to be smaller cities or in outlying areas where there's high growth going on. And with some of the smaller cities, some of these I don't even know, like Jant, I'm not even sure, for example, where that is. But sometimes that's driven by one project, one large project that's in a tax increment district, like Rogers, for example. I know they have the Cabela's, I think that was put in a tax increment district. And so some of that is what drives those very large numbers. It's probably somewhat more concerning when you see larger established cities that have higher percentages. Just to put this a little bit into perspective, you heard former chair Bill Kelly testify at the hearing on Friday, and when he was chair in 78, the bill he talked about would have put an absolute 10% cap on these numbers. So that if the city had more than 10%, they would not be permitted to certify a new TIF district. And I, you know, obviously that's an arbitrary sort of round number, but that was very controversial at the time, and as you indicated, it passed the House by a few votes, but then failed on the Senate floor by a few votes.
Mr. Michael. Mr. Bob?
Thank you. And Mr. Michael, I'm just wondering, is it possible or is it too much work to figure out, like if you have a school district that jumps over two or three different cities, has two or three different cities wrapped up in it, how much of a school district's property tax capacity is wrapped up in TIF? Because I think one of the things that, you know, we forget, and I think we actually brought out quite well the other day on Friday, is that they are accompanying these cities on this road, even though they have no say in whether they do or they don't. Is that an exercise in futility, or is that something that's not too hard?
Mr. Hines is the one that generates these numbers. I think that would be relatively easy for him to do. I think he's nodding yes. And so we could produce that for you. The one thing I will say is that these numbers generally with schools will drop because you're including, you know, particularly when you think in Greater Minnesota, for example, where the school districts include the agricultural areas, TIF districts are concentrated in the cities, and so these numbers will drop on average for the schools.
All right, members, we're going to take a recess then until 5:35. Take a bathroom break, refresh, find your radio, Representative Garofalo.
Lowry is done.
Representative Lowry, we're going to go on.
I could just schedule it tomorrow, but. All right, so you ready? Okay, the tax committee come back to order. Representative Mallory, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize, but
me too.
I had the delete all amendment to the bill, and I was getting all of the questions in the last committee on in my committee on my delete all amendments. This bill is getting at a problem that we created recently. And that was when we created the LLC, and with allowing the pass-through, which ended up with people putting, you could put a several million dollar home in Minnesota into an LLC, and then you lose the nexus for Minnesota to have it in there considered an asset in Minnesota because it suddenly becomes an intangible rather than a tangible, and for somebody that's not a resident of Minnesota, they were then able to avoid our taxes. And so what this does is close the loophole, and the technical parts of this I'd have to refer to Mr. Michael. He can do an even better job than me.
Thank you.
A vastly better job.
Thank you. Is there anyone who wants to testify for or against this bill? Okay, Mr. Michael, did you want to add anything? I think Representative Mallory, you explained it really well. Mr. Michael, anything that we missed?
Just one thing to clarify, that this, as Representative Mallory pointed out, this was stimulated by the 2008 change that allowed LLCs to be used for non-business purposes. But this bill actually is broader than that, and it applies to business assets too. So to the extent that someone has a partnership, an S-Corp, an LLC, that owns a business in Minnesota, but the owner is a non-resident and dies, those real estate, Minnesota real estate assets would be subject to the Minnesota estate tax. So it goes beyond the home example to include businesses as well.
Thank you. Questions? Discussion? Public? If not, we're going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and again, I apologize.
And Representative Hillstrom, perfect timing. Did we move Representative Mallory's bill? Yes. Okay, so now Representative Hillstrom now moves House Bill 1405 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was actually just presenting a bill on Representative Mallory's committee, so I'm late.
You're doing good.
Madam Chair, this was actually part of the department's bill that then I said we needed to hear in the Public Safety Committee, so we had separated it out. So I'd just like the department to talk about it.
Okay, thank you. Assistant Commissioner Cadoon, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as Representative Hillstrom said, this bill was then heard in her committee on the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee, and it was amended in that committee, and we do support the bill as it was amended. Just briefly to explain what the bill does, Department of Revenue is, correctly so, very restricted in our ability to release any taxpayer information. And taxpayer information is defined in the Tax Data Disclosures chapter, and it's a very broad term, and confidential information for a taxpayer would include even the name of the taxpayer, their address, the fact that they're even being audited or having any collection activity against them is also considered confidential. Current statute allows the department to disclose taxpayer information to law enforcement to the extent necessary to apprise law enforcement if taxpayers make threats of death or bodily injury. What the House File 1405 does is amend the statute to include situations where taxpayers harassing a Department of Revenue employee as a result of a Department of Revenue employee carrying out their job duties. The harassment must rise to the level of criminal harassment, and then we would be able to disclose to law enforcement just necessary some the fact that this harassment is going on. And it's really the intent is just to prevent this type of harassment from escalating into an even more serious threat. So that's it,
Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Okay, seeing none, Ms. Cadu, and thank you, Representative Hilton. The chair will lay over House File 1405 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, members.
Carolyn Chesky will move her bill 2172.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill essentially cleans up some technical issues that were related to the 3/8 1% sales tax that was passed by the voters. This bill puts the rate into the statute. It adds a provision explicitly codifying where the money goes rather than relying exclusively on the Constitution for that, and clarifies that the constitutional amendment does not apply to the sales tax on cars and trucks. So that's pretty much it. It's a technical cleanup to the 3/8 constitutional sales tax. And if there's detailed questions, Mr. Chair, I would defer them to Mr. Michael.
Thank you. Madam Chair, were you moving the A2 amendment as well?
Yes, please. I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
Then to put the bill in the shape that the author would like, all in favor of the A2 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Then thank you, Madam Chair. And you said you were deferring, Representative Wachewski, you were...
If there's further detail that members or the public wants, I think Mr. Michael is the right person. It's fairly technical.
Any other details that people want?
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to respond to questions if there are questions, but I'm not sure that anybody wants any more details.
Thank you, Mr. Michaels. Is there any testimony from the audience, either for or against this bill as amended? Seeing none, the Chair will lay over House File 2172 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, please adjourn.
Thank you.